Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
DUP ministers and some others hand back their phones and they're wiped by civil servants. Now, how on earth does that happen? Either you've got a system where people are so utterly incompetent that they think taking the First Minister's phone and wiping it is in any way acceptable, or somebody wanted to do this in complete defiance of what the executive had said.
It seems so long ago now, but the COVID-19 pandemic was an unprecedented event.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home.
There were 5,685 deaths in Northern Ireland, with the death certificate mentioned COVID as one possible cause.
There were not just many thousands of people who died, but there were really significant curtailments on our civil liberties as a population. That's something we need to understand. Did our government get it right?
Like all politicians and civil servants, ours were struggling with something new. But their actions and decisions are now under close scrutiny.
This is a rotten system where public servants paid for by us to maintain records, to honestly tell us what had happened and then to tell the inquiry, are altering that in a way that conceals what was actually happening.
The UK COVID-19 inquiry has been taking evidence here in Belfast. Our Northern Ireland editor, Sam McBride, has been following events and he joins me now in the line. Sam, I think we need to clarify for people what is the COVID inquiry? What exactly is its modus operandi?
This is a public inquiry. It's looking at the whole UK response to the pandemic. So it started sitting almost a year ago in London, spent most of its time sitting in London, but it's also been to Wales, to Scotland. It's now come to Belfast. And its interest here is looking at how the various devolved administrations in the UK handled this pandemic. So the way in which the UK is governed has changed, obviously, over recent decades. Power is not all held in London. And so what they're trying to get to is, did that work? Did it work well? Could it work better in future? And so they are in Belfast for 3 weeks. They are hearing evidence from civil servants. They're hearing evidence from Stormont ministers, from other people who had some role in this pandemic response in Northern Ireland. And also, very significantly, they are publishing a lot of written evidence. So things that they have got from people inside the Stormont system, mainly from government ministers, from senior civil servants, they're making that public in a way that we normally would not expect to see until many decades after the event.
Do you think it's a big deal or is it a paper exercise? I want to get this cynicism out of the road, I suppose.
Well, lots of people look at these things and think, sure, nothing ever changes. They'll talk about this. Lots of lawyers will make lots of money and not much else will really happen here. It's true that this is very expensive. This is going to cost probably more than £200 million in total for the whole UK. That's a lot of money. But I think that if a public inquiry is ever justified, it's justified in circumstances like this. There were not just many thousands of people who died from COVID, but there were really significant and very draconian curtailments on our civil liberties as a population. That's something we need to understand. Did we get it right? Did our government get it right? Could they have done things differently? Should they have done things in a better way? And it's not just about us. We might live through another pandemic, or we may not. Who knows? But if we don't, our descendants most certainly will. Pandemics come and they come again. And so therefore, this is about trying to understand what has happened here. But it's not just about COVID. If you think back to the RHI inquiry, that was on one level about a green heating scheme, but it was about so much more than that. It was about how we're governed as a society. And that is what this inquiry is also delving into. And it's one of the things that is most interesting, I think, to people who, even if they had no particular personal impact from the pandemic, or they were fortunate enough not to get seriously ill or lose someone close to them, this matters to everybody, no matter what their status in life, no matter what their politics. And what this is exposing about Stormont, about its very secretive system, is very, very significant.
Democracy, transparency and accountability, those things cost money, and some people do make money out of them, I suppose. But I think we should clarify for people, there will not be the truth coming out of this. That is to say, the various truths that people believe in. This will probably be quite a technical, multifaceted report in the end, which will take a lot of time to digest for people, and there won't be an easy answer.
No, but I think that if we take the view that we're never going to get perfection, but if we get something that's a bit better than what we had, that's an improvement. It's progress. It's chipping away at a big problem. And so we can improve how we're governed in the here and now if we learn some of the lessons from this. And also then, in terms of future pandemics, future health crises, we can learn from this. So the first significant element of this will be the final report that comes from Diarmaid Hallett when she publishes her findings from this very long process. So whatever about the final outcome of this, just getting the evidence out there in public, letting us all as individuals see it, hear it, ponder it, think, is that right? Am I happy about how my public representatives, public servants have operated here? That has value in itself.
Well, let's look at some of the headlines and the stories coming out of the inquiry so far. Now, first up, and I think this is my personal favourite, dysfunctional bastards.
Well, this was the language of Sir Michael McBride. I should make clear that he's not a relative of mine. He was and still is the chief medical officer in Northern Ireland, very experienced. And he was the person who had really very significant power during the pandemic. Power that he probably never expected to have, but it's clear from looking at some of the evidence that has been published that both civil servants at the very top of the organisation and senior politicians were really constantly going to Sir Michael McBride and saying, what do you think? What does Michael think about this? Is Michael happy? Would Michael be okay for us to do this? He is the person who they're turning to because they don't know anything about pandemics for the most part. They don't know anything about this particular type of novel coronavirus. And so, like the rest of us, they're wondering, what do we do here? And he is the person that is channeling expert advice from London, from the centre of power there, and also from medics in Northern Ireland. But it's clear as well that he was deeply unimpressed with some of the politicians he was dealing with. It's not just this colourful turn of phrase. There are multiple occasions where he is saying to Stormont civil servants that they're being held back by ministers. Now, some ministers will not be happy with this. They will see this as overreach by somebody who's a civil servant, who doesn't have a democratic mandate. Other people will look at this and say he was the person who was trying to stay out of the politics of this, and these people were dysfunctionally fighting in Stormont executive meetings where he was present. They were lobbying for things that were maybe pet projects or things that suited their orange or green stances. And so what is clear, whichever side you take there, is that this was very much less than optimal. You had the person who was the chief medical advisor to the executive, and you had the executive at deep variance with each other at various points, and very little respect, I think it's fair to say, from Sir Michael McBride, at least, towards some of these people he's dealing with.
In all fairness to everyone involved, the pandemic brought about an awful lot of uncertainty. No one really knew what they were doing because they were dealing with something which they had never dealt with before. And naturally, the medics, scientists, they wanted the harshest lockdown possible because naturally and rationally, they wanted to minimise the number of deaths and illnesses because of COVID-19. But I mean, surely we must see it also from the politicians' point of view. in that they don't want to take away, in theory at least, from the people, from their voters, their civil liberties, because that would be, well, a moral question in itself and indeed an electoral issue down the line. So, I mean, there was always going to be these tensions, were there not? It's just inevitable.
There were. And look, this was happening around the world in any non-authoritarian system, at least. There was a healthy questioning of what should we do? How far should we go? What do we reasonably do here? And what is going too far? I think that when you look at some of the evidence, both oral evidence to the inquiry and written evidence of what was being said at the time, it brings back to me that there is so much of this that we have forgotten about, that we've put to the back of our minds, that we maybe want to forget about because it was so scary, it was so unknown, it was so terrifying in many ways. But if you look at what Naomi Long was saying, the then Justice Minister, still our Justice Minister, she was talking about large numbers of opened graves in graveyards. There were diggers, there was heavy machinery present in graveyards in preparation for what they feared would be mass deaths. They were preparing a resting facility, as they called it quite euphemistically, a place that was a very large morgue at Kinnegar Army Barracks near Hollywood. And there were some really grim preparations here. And I think that when you listen to some of what comes out of the wilder conspiracy theorists about this, my experience of government is that government doesn't waste money on something if it doesn't believe it's genuinely going to happen. They had seen Italy, they had seen China, they'd seen America. They knew that we were in a worse position in terms of ICU beds, in terms of some other metrics for how we might be able to cope with this in Northern Ireland. And they were genuinely scared. And when you look at this, I think you have to have significant sympathy for executive ministers, for civil servants, the best people in the world, the most noble people, the most capable people, the most honest people would have made enormous mistakes here. They didn't know what to do. All of the options in front of them were going to hurt somebody. So we have to be very forgiving, I think, of people who made honest mistakes there. I think, unfortunately, some of the evidence that we've had so far is not about people making honest mistakes in the heat of a massive crisis where they didn't know what to do. It's about people deleting things after the event. It's about people not being open with the inquiry about what they know. And that, I think, we should be much more careful about quickly saying, well, that's okay, that doesn't really matter, because that does matter. And that's about trying to get the truth of what happened here so that hopefully we can learn from what actually did go wrong here.
And we do have to stress that in this conversation, because I think we are going to speak about these negative elements. But in comparison to, say, Brazil, the United States of America, Italy, and certainly China, I mean, we got off lightly, and that doesn't mean to take away anything from the people who have suffered and have lost relatives. But there are key indicators, I suppose, of dysfunctionality. And it's the old classic, notes were lost, but now have been found, unless they have been deleted.
Well, yes. I mean, this is something which was very almost eerily familiar to me, having sat through all of the RHI inquiry and having been told by Stormont after that, we fixed this, we've sorted it, we're a very reformed civil service, we don't behave like that anymore, it's a new dawn. Well, suddenly a lot of this sounds just like deja vu to me. So you've got this situation where Stormont executive meetings are obviously very confidential. If you put in a Freedom of Information request for the notes of a Stormont executive meeting, you will not get them. They're not released for about 20 years until all government records of that nature are being declassified at the Public Record Office. But what we find here is something that even I, having written about Stormont for many, many years, wasn't aware of, that actually there was one official record, the minutes of Stormont executive meetings, but hidden behind that was a second, far fuller record of what happened at those meetings. They were the handwritten notes of the people who were there as civil servants to record what was said. They then, if you like, sanitized those to a significant extent, shortened them to a very significant extent, and turned those into a set of minutes that might be something like 4 pages long, large type, not very many words, not much detail of what actually happened. So-and-so decided we would do this, bam, next thing, that's it. What you see here is that when the inquiry asked for minutes, they got suspicious because there was so little in them. And they said, is there anything else? And then Stormont said, well, actually, yes, there is. We've got these handwritten notes. So they gave them some of these handwritten notes. And it's clear from those that they, in some cases, run to maybe 50 pages. They're incredibly detailed. They give you a blow-by-blow account of who said what, who was threatening to do this or do that, who was shouting at who. But then the inquiry realised that a key meeting, the notes of a meeting on the 2nd of July 2020, hadn't been given to them. And they asked about that. And they asked about that because that was the first executive meeting after the funeral of the former IRA commander, Bobby Storey. That's very familiar to most people in Northern Ireland now, I think. But just to recap, there were thousands of people on the streets of West Belfast. The top brass of Sinn Féin were there. There were Stormont ministers from Sinn Féin there. They had been saying to people, don't do this. Then they were doing it. There was enormous anger, enormous controversy about this, and still is to this day. And so the minutes of this meeting said very little, but these notes that said a lot more hadn't been given. So to cut a long story short, the inquiry asked about 10 times for Stormont to give these over, and they didn't get them. And it was only at the start of hearings in Belfast about 10 days ago when they made public that this had happened. The following day, they got a letter from Stormont's lawyers who gave the impression that there was some misunderstanding here. They were all terribly surprised about what had happened. Oh, and by the way, here are these notes. You can have them now. But actually, when the timeline was laid out by counsel to the inquiry, it's clear Stormont Castle, Stormont's executive office, knew that they had these notes from last August, and they didn't give them to the inquiry. So a very alarming element, I think, of secrecy there. Either at the most charitable view of this, complete incompetence, where these people don't know where things are, they can't keep them securely, they just lose them, they can't give them in, or someone deciding, you know what, this is politically awkward, let's not bother.
You mentioned the Bobby Storey funeral, and obviously that was and is a massive story, Sam. And for people whose parents died alone and who were buried alone or practically alone and they couldn't attend a funeral, this seemed like an hypocrisy on a massive scale. And I think for the vast majority of people would agree with that. Now, we know that online, on the radio, everywhere, that Sinn Féin have been very, very defensive about what happened with that funeral. But Carol Ní Chulainn seems to have had a change of heart with the passing of time.
Yes, this evidence was, I think it's fair to say, quite surprising. It was surprising because it was so comprehensive and because it was so unambiguous. Carol Ní Chulainn came to the inquiry. She was asked by a barrister for the families of those who died during COVID about what had happened here. And rather than the familiar sort of careful, quite slippery forms of words that Sinn Féin have used about this, people like Michelle O'Neill have talked in very elliptic terms about this in a way that doesn't actually say that they're really sorry for having gone to it or that they've any regret for that, but tries to say that they're sorry for the hurt that was caused, etc. There was none of that from Carol Ní Chulainn. She said to the inquiry in writing, first of all, that Bobby Storey had been a dear friend. She said it was wrong to use her ministerial car to go. But when she was pressed by the inquiry, she admitted that before she went to that funeral, she knew that it was going to undermine the COVID response in Northern Ireland. Now, that's a massive thing, a massive concession. It wasn't that she stumbled into this and she was surprised at how many people showed up or anything of that nature. She knew what was happening. That might seem obvious now, but it's not what Sinn Féin has been saying up until now. And secondly, and I think very significantly for some of the families who were there, she said that she was sorry for what had happened. She said that she shouldn't have gone. She shouldn't have taken her ministerial car. And she said that she had given the money back to taxpayers for having done so. But then she was asked by this barrister for the families, surely it's not that you shouldn't have gone in the car. You shouldn't have gone at all. And she basically said, yes, she shouldn't have gone. So I think that what that caused me to wonder is we've had this rupture, if you like, in the executive. This led to the ending of the joint press conferences between Arlene Foster and Michelle O'Neill. That had been a symbol of unity, even where there was fighting in the background. That was something that said we're working together in this. If this had happened at the time, Sinn Féin had come out very quickly and said, look, this was a dreadful error. We shouldn't have done this and we're really sorry about it.
We have also been finding out about the DUP position about the lockdown, and of course, you know, in reference to the Bobby Storey funeral, etc. Some may remember that the DUP took a more sceptical view of restrictions in people's liberty, frankly, in the effort to restrict the virus. What more have we found out about that?
Well, I think we've found out something which has quite surprised me, frankly, because the very interesting evidence of Edwin Poots, who I think it's fair to say was the chief skeptic within the executive, within the DUP, was much more skeptical than Arlene Foster about lockdown. His evidence is much more nuanced than you might imagine. He says to the inquiry, or said to the inquiry, that he thought that Stormont had made a mistake in not locking down earlier. He said they had made a mistake in following London too closely and following Boris Johnson's advice too closely. Now, that is not what the popular narrative is. It's not what I would have thought had actually happened. There was a very clear sense that one side of the executive, the orange side, if you like, was going with London. The other side, the green side, if you like, was going with Dublin. And that was quite a stark divide in the early days of the pandemic. Here you have Edwin Poots, albeit looking back in hindsight, saying, we made a mistake by not moving quicker. And actually, that would have meant moving more closely in line with what the Irish Republic was doing. But then he says, we made a mistake in not moving to end some of those restrictions earlier. So he is making the argument that they should have essentially put people who were most vulnerable into severe restrictions, or advised them of that, but let other people get on with their lives. Now, then the very significant controversial element of this is when you get to late 2020, autumn 2020, COVID cases are going up. There's a real concern that the health system can't cope with this. And the recommendation from the chief medical officer, from the chief scientific officer, is that there should be a period of extra restrictions in Northern Ireland. The DUP not just are very opposed to this, but they wield their veto in the executive. That was a veto that was designed to protect unionism or nationalism against each other, but they use it to block a unionist minister, Robin Swan, from extending restrictions. Now, that's something that we see from some of the text messages here that a very senior civil servant called Andrew McCormick texted Michael McBride, the chief medical officer, to say he was appalled at some of the comments from Diane Dodds. He said that she had a total lack of any concept of how the health and social care system works. And there is a sense here that behind the scenes, civil servants are not just annoyed at the DUP, but they're angry at them. You've got Michael McBride being praised by Dr. McCormick for having given what he said was very proportionate and irrefutable advice in the face of some terribly manipulative behaviour. And then he adds to that, DUP will regret this. Michael McBride replies, I suspect we will become the cannon fodder, however, shameless misuse and misrepresentation of what we did say. And then Andrew McCormick replies, like Winston Smith in 1984, that's George Orwell's novel, we know the truth and will not forget it.
Viruses, of course, don't discriminate on the basis of class or status or background. So I think we should point out probably that two of the MLAs on the executive, Naomi Long and Edwin Poots, they were affected personally by this pandemic.
That's right. And there was evidence from both of them on that, from the Justice Minister on losing both of her parents in March of 2020, just as COVID was really ramping up in a very alarming way, for her not being able to grieve them properly. There were very severe restrictions on going to graveyards, on burials, etc. And then some very emotional testimony from Edwin Poots, where he told the inquiry about the death of his father, who'd been a DUP councillor, Charlie Poots. And he said he could remember him taking on well. They phoned for an ambulance. The ambulance came. They had all of the very restrictive things there in terms of trying to protect themselves from somebody who might have COVID. They took him to the Ulster Hospital. Mr. Poots said that he followed in a car. They got to the outside of the hospital. They weren't allowed in. And he said that he then finally saw his father briefly before he died. He became very emotional about that. There were very severe restrictions on the burial, etc. And ultimately, Edwin Putt said that even though he had been one of the ministers that had been voting for those restrictions, who believed that they had been right, he said that in hindsight, having gone through that, they were cruel. He was certainly very clearly quite regretful about what had happened. Now, he made clear that even with hindsight, he thinks that in March of 2020, based on what they knew, based on what they thought was coming towards them, it was the right thing to do. It was horrible, but it was necessary, he thought. But as time went on, he said it was increasingly hard to justify. And at a certain point, he said it was unjustifiable.
So there does seem to be a lot of reflection from our politicians, and we've acknowledged in our discussion the difficulties that they would have faced. However, I mean, we're not here to talk about people personally, although we have to take that into account, of course. But let's talk about the system, and I know that you have been looking at what this inquiry has told us so far about the Stormont political system. And what you have said, and you've made no bones about it, with its secrecy stripped away, the rottenness of the Stormont system is being exposed. You're not being a little harsh, no?
Well, I think that if you look at what's happened here, it's very important to see this in context. We're not entirely unique in terms of records being deleted, in terms of WhatsApp being used for a proxy, if you like, for what would previously have been done in a Stormont executive room, in a cabinet room, etc. But I think there is a massive difference in Northern Ireland. We went through the RHI inquiry. We spent more than £20 million on that inquiry. It was rigorous. It was harsh in terms of shining a big spotlight on the Stormont civil service, on Stormont ministers, on how the whole system operated. And after that process, we were told that they had learned their lessons. We were told they'd fixed this. We were told that will not happen again. And here you see them. Actually, before the RHI inquiry report had even been published, lapsing back into some of the same behaviour here, where there are records not being kept, where one record doesn't tell the full story and a hidden record tells a much fuller story, where phones are being wiped by the civil service after the event, where some ministers are wiping their phones after the event, where some ministers like Arlene Foster, who had gone through the RHI inquiry at a very senior level, are saying to this inquiry, oh, I didn't use my official phone, I used my private phone. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means many things, but one of them is that she had control over her information, over her data. It didn't go into the civil service system. She decided what was released. If I or anybody who's listening to this made a Freedom of Information request for records which related to her that were linked to her phone, that was up to her as to whether she gave them over. Nobody else could see those. It also meant that there were questions around the level of security of her phone, because it was not a government phone. It was not operating to those standards. So massive, massive problems here. And then you get right up to the present day, where after this happens, after COVID has passed, the inquiry go to Stormont and they say two things. First of all, they say, retain all your records, don't destroy anything. And they specifically say, retain WhatsApps, retain text messages, retain these informal forms of communication between ministers and senior civil servants. And what happens? DUP ministers and some others hand back their phones and they're wiped by civil servants. Now, how on earth does that happen? Either you've got a system where people are so utterly incompetent that they think taking the First Minister's phone and wiping it is in any way acceptable, or somebody wanted to do this in complete defiance of what the executive had said. Now, there's been no evidence that that was taken consciously, but I think it's a reasonable suspicion to have here, given the complete incredulity I think that most people would have, that anybody could think that was in any way appropriate. And then secondly, what the inquiry asked for was some details around that process. And what they discovered was that last May 2023, Stormont's executive office, the top department in Stormont with the First Minister and the Deputy First Minister, that department realised that phones had been wiped. It knew it had a massive problem. So whatever had happened before then, we don't know. But we do know that last May, they knew this had happened. And what did they do? They had a meeting. It seems that that was discussed at that meeting. And there were minutes of that meeting. And initially, those minutes showed what had been discussed and said, the phones have been wiped and we need to tell the inquiry. Now, that's fairly straightforward. What happened after that was that those minutes were redrafted 13 times. 13 times. And at the end of that process, they didn't say the phones had been wiped and they didn't say they had to tell the inquiry. Nobody, to the best of my knowledge, has been disciplined for that. Nobody has given any coherent public explanation of what happened there. Jane Brady, the head of the civil service, has admitted that there is no credible explanation that she can think of for that. This is a rotten system where public servants paid for by us to maintain records, to honestly tell us or to tell the internal Stormont record as it was then what had happened and then to tell the inquiry are altering that in a way that conceals what was actually happening. That is not in the public interest. And also, this is a system where we're being told repeatedly by civil servants they lack resources, they need more people, they don't have enough bodies to do basic functions of good government. And here they are. They've got the time to do 13 rewrites of a minute to alter what actually we are told was said. I mean, that is rotten.
This inquiry is expected to cost more than £200 million. There'll be plenty of headlines out of it. It's a good story for us. From the public's point of view, do you think that's money well spent?
It's far too early to say, Kieran, to be honest. I think what we do have to face up to is that if you have any public inquiry, it's going to be very expensive. What the Institute for Government say is that they think this inquiry will cost more than £200 million. It will go beyond what had previously been the most expensive inquiry, which was Lord Savile's inquiry into Bloody Sunday. That cost just over £200 million. And so this is something that is going to be drawn out. It's going to take a lot of time. It's going to take a lot of effort. There are lots of lawyers involved in it. Different people will be looking at this for different things. Some of the families of those who died in COVID are looking for answers. They're looking for something that can give them some comfort. That might not be possible for some of those people. They obviously can't get back what they most want to get back, which is their loved one. But I think that at least if those people were able to look at this and say it has delivered something that makes it less likely that somebody else goes through what we've gone through, well, that's something. I mean, it's not great, but it's something. I think if at the end of this feels like something which has in any way not got to the bottom of things, which has covered things up, which has failed to have the expertise to understand certain elements of this, or has been in any way cowed by government or afraid to get into certain elements of this, that will be very difficult. And I think the final element of this, which is very, very important, is that this inquiry needs to be incredibly transparent. Any public inquiry has an expectation of transparency. It's paid for by the public. It costs a lot of money. And we expect to see an exceptional level of transparency because of that. But here you have got very unique circumstances. There are wild, as we know, completely wild conspiracy theories about COVID. Some quite reasonable people have fallen into believing some of those conspiracy theories. You'll never convince most of those people, I think it's fair to say, that those theories are wrong. However, you can only ever think of the reasonable people who are looking at this in a rational way and are weighing up the evidence and saying, look, is that credible or is that not credible? And if this inquiry is seen to hide a lot, if it's seen to not publish lots of what's given to it, if it's seen to censor and redact lots of what's given to it, I think that will fuel conspiracy theories and people who are drawn to them. If, on the other hand, it's open, if it's honest, if it seemed to be grappling with the difficulty of this, I think that actually could help to, in some ways, restore some confidence that this wasn't what some people were claiming it was, this grand conspiracy, that government actually was grappling with a horrible, hellish situation which nobody could have perfectly dealt with. They got it badly wrong in some instances. There was some very bad behaviour that should be exposed. Those people should be disciplined if necessary. But for the most part, they were trying to do the right thing.
Sam McBride, Northern Ireland editor with the Belfast Telegraph. Thank you very much.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.